Hi, Bob's here. This week I'm at a family funeral, so there won't be a new episode. However, please enjoy this favourite from the archive, and we'll be back in 2 weeks with a new one. Thank you.
This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatise mental health. I'm Bobby Temps, and each week with an inspiring guest, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. So, here we go.
This week, we're talking about the big one. Stigma is our theme. And this is one that you may not have realized I'm kind of protective over, because combating stigma is the core of what this show is about. And so I can be quite particular about what guests, you know, get this theme that we actually kind of rarely cover. It's something that I guess in different ways we explore in every episode, but having stigma itself as the theme is not that often. And so I'm delighted to say that this week's guest did not disappoint when talking all things stigma. Barbara Brennan is the coordinator of Sea Change, Ireland's national program dedicated to ending mental health stigma and discrimination, who you may have noticed we've been having an ongoing collaboration with, and having recently had interviews with two of their ambassadors and now the coordinator of the entire program herself. And we got into a lot. I looked at the time at the end of this episode and I was quite surprised, honestly, with just how much we packed in. The time hadn't got away from me. This is a regular length episode. But between us, we crammed it in. No bit of stigma was left unmentioned, unaddressed, or unchallenged. And before we get into the episode, I just wanted to share a little bit about a realization, a kind of breakthrough I had recently, which I mentioned briefly in the debrief part of the conversation, you know, the bit that's behind a paywall for our premium subscribers on Apple Podcasts. This one did not disappoint. We had a good laugh. We really brought the energy up at the end of this conversation when having the debrief that our subscribers get to exclusively listen to. So if you want to try that out, quick plug, this might be the one. You can get a free trial on Apple Podcasts for a month and go listen to that and see what you think. But I did say I'd talk about this in the intro, so here goes. The realization I had recently, which both delighted and sort of quietly floored me, was that I have successfully created a life at this point where there is zero expectation for me to be unemotional, for me to avoid talking about mental health, for me to avoid talking about, in fact, a range of quote-unquote controversial topics, as some people might frame them. And in fact, that extends as far as the expectation is now the opposite. And I sometimes joke with friends about this, that I'm in many ways kind of known for being a man with emotions at this point and for talking about mental illness very specifically, including my own experience. And it's an interesting thing to be known for. But the most recent realization has been just how freeing that is and just how far I've come from how much I used to shy away and really how I knew nothing as a young person that needed to know about mental health, but knew virtually nothing. And that did have a negative impact in a lot of ways. And so maybe I'm saying something that's obvious to you as a listener, but for me, putting these pieces together and realizing I now have a life where no one expects me to be unemotional. In fact, some people might even be disappointed if I don't talk about feelings at times, because that's what they expect from me, is such a freedom that I really needed and that I'm delighted to get to be a part of for other people. You know, maybe this is the one explicit conversation about mental illness you hear in your week. And that's such a privilege. And if I'm happy or if I'm sad in that episode, it does not seem to make a difference. People will listen. People will relate to either emotion. And that's so exciting. It really is. I've got this like fucking temptation to like squeal, to make squeaky, bubbly noises that won't make any sense on audio. But yeah, some breakthroughs are fucking rough and some are just like eat great. And yeah, with that fun energy, we'll get into this conversation with someone else who is very much in that place of openness and, you know, reveling in how stigma is on the decline. So please welcome Barbara Brennan in a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
So my name is Barbara, and I suppose two different times sprang to mind when I was thinking about early memories of my mental health, because I now understand that mental health is all-encompassing, whereas when we were talking about mental health when I was younger, it was, you know, mental illness, and it really meant something very different. So I suppose to speak to that first, I would have been about 11 turning 12. And that really was a very difficult time because I was changing schools. I was doing a lot of different things. I was really badly bullied at the time. And it just fed into the negative feeling that I had about myself and that validation that I wasn't good enough. So there was a lot around that. So I suppose that's my first mental health or more mental illness memory. But going back further to that, I suppose there's memories as far back as a very small child of always being a sensitive child, that I would cry easily or that I would get upset about things. I was overly emotional is what I was always called, whereas now, you know, we see it as an empath and we understand more about different kinds of personalities. And it's just that I feel things very strongly and that I care very deeply. Whereas when I was a child, it was very much, I kind of suck it up, get over it. You know, obviously from my parents' perspective, I would get pug or I would get whatever. But I think those kind of memories of having something happen and being deeply upset about it. And a silly example would be, for example, I remember once seeing a glove on the side of the road, getting really upset about whoever lost it because their hands would be cold or one hand would be cold and maybe they wouldn't have enough money to replace them. Or if it was a child, maybe they were going to get in trouble when they went home that they had lost their glove. So I was always very emotionally involved in other people's stories. So I suppose for me, learning about mental health and what that meant to me across my lifetime has given me a different view of my childhood and my growing up years.
For sure. And I first off want to highlight how much I appreciate that distinction between mental illness and mental health. That's something that I bang on about all the time. And, you know, I think is a really important part of tackling stigma, of redefining those terms and making sure that's solid in everybody's mind, because otherwise that holds people back from having what can be quite neutral conversations around mental health, you know, that could even include how you're feeling in a positive way could be considered a mental health conversation. But so often that bias is towards thinking of the sharp other end of the mental health spectrum.
Absolutely. And I love that because it is that thing where I think people are only starting to understand now, all these years later, mental health is something that we all have. And it is actually in the things that we talk about, asking people how they are and acknowledging, like during the pandemic, that we were struggling with loneliness or these different things. That's our mental health. And I think it is really important for people to understand that it is a precious thing that we need to be aware of and mind it and feed it. And that if we don't, that it can have a negative impact and can bring us to a more negative place. And that for people to understand that mental illness isn't just a select few. It is possible that anybody can experience a mental illness. But I think it is a fascinating concept. And for somebody who had really severe mental illness at a very young age, I wish I had that understanding before, because I really thought something was wrong with me because I didn't know how to fix it. But I didn't understand also that there were things I could do or things that I was doing that was making it worse, that I could have done things differently that maybe would have helped.
Yes. And I love seeing those conversations develop. And also, you know, what you said there about how much easier it might have been in some ways to wrap your head around experience of mental illness if you knew anything about it is something I totally relate to. It can be so much easier to find yourself thinking that you're broken or you're somehow kind of irreparably damaged because you're experiencing these difficult emotions or a particular diagnosis. Of course, we're going to fall into that thinking if we don't know any better. And it's, you know, lovely in my work to be the example of the opposite, where in a way this podcast has become a massive archive of just how possible recovery is through so many examples that we're still not used to seeing. And the other thing I want to mentioned, because I really related to it, is what you said about the glove. Because even that, I'm glad that's not just me, because I've had that one. And another one I'm reminded of is I can't even think of somebody dropping ice cream, particularly a child, without feeling upset by that. I've never seen it happen. I've never had to comfort a child who's dropped ice cream. And yet there's something about, hopefully it's a side of empathy, that so often people that have experienced difficult times can relate to experiences in others that they may not have even had. And I think that's such a superpower of this, that without the conversations, we don't realize some of the advantages we have through our shared experience.
I totally agree. And I think the flip side of it as well, thinking about the impact of it, is that when we don't share that, we also live in this really small little bubble. And quite often that bubble is full of shame. And it's this piece of, there's something wrong with me and it's my fault. And it's something that I feel ashamed of, something that I'm embarrassed by. What if somebody finds out? And I think for me, that is really at the heart of what stigma is. That, you know, we're using the word stigma a lot more these days, but I still think that people don't really get what it means, as in what it feels like. You know, what kind of behaviors would I see or experience or even do myself if I was experiencing being stigmatized, or even if I was stigmatizing somebody else or stigmatizing myself? And I think that's something that we need to understand, that we've got health and then we've got illness. And somewhere in between, we may have mental health difficulties. But alongside that, above the regular life bit, is stigma. So really, it's a matter of when somebody is experiencing a difficulty with a physical health challenge, they're going to have all of the things that come with that and all the thoughts and feelings that they come with that. But most often, the kind of shame that they might experience isn't to do with blame. You know, like maybe they will go through a number of different feelings around it, but quite often the thing about mental illness is there's this piece of needing to hide it and feeling ashamed and feeling embarrassed by it. That I think when people have physical illnesses, if they feel those things, they come through them a bit faster and realize that the support is there. And it's been historically a lot harder for people because they've witnessed the judgment. Because even when we think about, even only 30 to 50 years ago, think about our mental institutions. Think of the way that those buildings looked. Think about where they were. They were outside of our society, you know, and this idea of you'll send me to the madhouse. You know, the language that our grandparents and great-grandparents used. And also the idea that if you went there or you were put there, that's it. You're never going to work again. You know, you're always going to be labeled as the crazy lady, or those really stigmatizing ideas. They weren't that long ago. So it's very understandable how strong and how alive stigma is now, and that really we're only starting to get to the point of understanding. When we say stigma, what is that? And starting to realize it's stereotyping. It's looking at what prejudice means. It's looking at discriminatory acts and realizing that there are certain things we're doing that falls into discrimination that maybe we weren't aware. So it's a really fascinating topic for me to help people understand that when we break down the blocks of stigma, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about the public side of something being done to you. We're talking about your internal monologue and that self-criticism all banging up on you. And then we're also talking about this way of starting to have a different conversation around tackling what we think we know from a prejudice perspective, and kind of where did that information come from, and does it hold true for this person that's standing in front of me? Having experienced stigma early in my life, but not realizing that's what it was, I find it really interesting to reflect on it now and consider that maybe people who judged me or treated me negatively, they were just coming from a fearful place and they didn't know any different, or they didn't know how to talk about it. And it wasn't that they were terrible people. It was that they were afraid of saying the wrong thing.
Yeah. And that's something that I come across, as I'm sure you do all the time still in our work, that a lot of times there can be that difficult line to tread of both needing to eradicate stigma and correct people's language and take certain steps, but also having the understanding that that doesn't necessarily mean people are coming from a bad place. You know, we can have both empathy and that kind of drive for change within it. And when you look back, what was your experience in those early teens like of coming to terms with your experiences of mental illness alongside other people's perception of that?
In the beginning, we didn't know that that's what it was. Nobody talked about mental illness. So, and then I suppose the way we found out that I was mentally unwell was that I made an attempt on my life and I ended up in hospital because they needed to save my life. And when I was released from there, I had to go straight to psychiatric care. So that was the beginning of my journey. And I would have been a week after my 14th birthday at that point. And so what other people would have witnessed was an angry teenager who wasn't sleeping well, who had lots of aches and pains, who was hormonal, you know, and that was the understanding at the time that it was, you know, this is normal for teenagers to go through this. You know, everybody talks about teenage years and how challenging it is for the teenager and the parent and anybody else that's around these angry people. But the difference, I suppose, for me was that it was lasting, that it had a negative impact on how my whole life functioned and that it was wholly negative, that it really brought me down this negative spiral and that negatively impacted my life. So it was an amalgamation of those number of things. So I suppose for me, that piece around the impact of it, really, I don't think I realized the impact until several years later. But what I witnessed the first time, I missed like most of my third year, and I would have been straight A student, and I came back and all of a sudden, you know, I used to be a singer in my local church. I used to run for my county. I used to swim for my county. I was involved in all different types of things. And suddenly there was this disengaged person who was moody and angry and sad all the time and didn't know how to respond to things. And so I dropped out of my life because I found it too hard to engage, and I found it too hard to ridicule that I got or the judgment that came across. And it's fair to say I was also bullied at school very badly around the same kind of time. So that alongside the bit of stigma and a story to illustrate what stigma looks like. I suppose when we're not actively trying to do it to somebody, mm-hmm. really was, you know, showing up to school. And you can imagine, you know, a really busy period in between classes where there's loads of students coming up and down the corridors. You've got the lockers banging, there's people in making tea in the canteen, all this, lots of noise, lots of chatter. And I would go to my locker and you're nearly forcing your way through people to get there. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly I turn around and the hallway would nearly be empty. Or I would go into the canteen and like that, there would be no seats to be had. And I'd go to get my water for my tea and I would turn around and there would be so many different seats available. And you could nearly see people putting their heads down going, don't engage, don't look at her. She won't sit beside me if I don't look at her. And what I felt at the time was that it was a real othering, you know, that I was different than them, that they didn't want me, that they were ashamed, that they were afraid of me. So I did what stigma told me to do and I started isolating myself because I didn't want that treatment. I didn't want that judgment. I didn't want to face that fear in other people's faces. So I stopped going to the canteen. I stopped going to the hall at times when other people were going to be there. And eventually I stopped going to school. So that's something that I think is really powerful to understand the impact of stigma. And what I understand now going back all these years is that it's not that any one of those people wanted to hurt me or damage me. I think realistically what it was that they knew I had been through a really difficult time. I had been labeled with the D word and nobody knew how to say it. Mm-hmm. They were afraid of talking to me because suicide and an attempt on my life had been part of my story. And I mean, you know, the myth is out there. If you talk about it, you make it worse. So people were terrified.
And that's something I've heard you talk about previously, is how so often people are held back by feeling they don't have the perfect thing to say, when in fact, yeah. often listening is kind of the perfect thing to say, is nothing, is asking open-ended questions and being there to really find out, how are you?
It is. And I think one of the most freeing things that I have said to people, and I say it over and over again, because I think what it is a match of people being afraid to say the wrong thing and wanting to have the answer. Yeah. They want to have the things, they want to have the advice. So when you merge the two of those things, it just creates a perfect storm that then we're terrified of saying anything. So we say nothing. And so the bit that I say it's two-pronged. The first bit is that in saying nothing, we're now not just talking about mental health. We're not talking about what's on telly. We're not talking about the weather. We're not talking about school. We're not talking about anything. And that is really powerful, because you've got to remember that the person who's experiencing the mental health and the stigma is also losing these conversations from everybody and isolating themselves. So they need that social interaction. But then the other side of it is, from that need to fix, that most likely the person that's in front of us, this isn't their first time experiencing these difficult things, but it might be their first time experiencing stigma. And exactly what you said, that we need to listen. It's why we've got two ears and one mouth, because we should listen twice as much. But what we can say is, I'm afraid of saying the wrong thing. I'm afraid that I'm going to upset you, or I don't know what to say. And I think that lifts a huge amount of worry from the listener to say, well, what if I say the wrong thing? Well, what if you do? If you've already said, I'm worried about saying the wrong thing, can you help me through that? Can you tell me if I say something wrong? It now gives relief to the person listening, but it also means that if the listener does say something that comes across in a difficult way, that the other person knows that it isn't meant intentionally negatively, and that they feel more open to say, actually, I'd rather you didn't say that, or would you mind saying it a different way, or something around that. It just opens a different conversation.
I love that approach. And the only thing I would add there is, one of the things I wish everybody knew is that when you're experiencing or have experienced mental illness, we're not expecting you to have the answer, because we know how hard it is to find firsthand, and that there is no magic solution, but really it's a whole kind of mixing pot of different things towards recovery. We're not looking for the perfect thing. We're not looking for the answer. We're just looking for people to be there and to not be on our own.
Yeah. And you know, the really interesting thing is, in doing all the work that I've done, certainly in the last 10 years in this area, when I work with groups and we talk about, you know, if you were to tell a secret to somebody, what would you need in order to tell them that secret? We talk about things like a space to be heard, safe place, non-judgmental attitude. You know, we talk about all these different things, confidentiality. But not one person has come to me and said, I want that person to be an expert. I want that person to fix it for me. And I find that fascinating, that yet we have this idea that when we're the listener, that, oh, I'm not a trained counsellor, or I'm not trained in this. And what I love to say to people is, look, if you know how to boil a kettle, and you know how to sit and have a chat about whatever, that qualifies you enough to sit and listen to the response. And I think that's the thing as well, that quite often when we think about listening, we're so caught up in trying to have the answer that now we're listening for the gap, and we're listening to respond rather than listening to understand. So again, I think allowing people to have that space to say, actually, silence in a conversation can be really healthy. And it shows that you're listening, or for you to be able to say to somebody, I'm really listening to what you're saying, and I just need a minute to let that sink in, so that you're comfortable sitting in that silence. You know, I think it's a skill that people have lost, because we're so busy and because we feel like we have to have all the answers, that sometimes it's actually really healthy to say, I don't have the answer, or I need to understand that a little bit differently, or tell me more about that.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think it's such a superpower, you know, that ability to hold space. And it does start with listening, and it also includes, you know, reflecting back things that that person is talking about. You know, it's not actually necessarily adding anything new to the conversation. And, you know, particularly there, that pull that I absolutely can relate to want to have the answers. I still think that even can be unintentionally tied up with stigma as well, where there is this feeling that mental illness is something that always needs to be fixed, and fixed quickly, and fixed for good. And, you know, that's why there is this pull that we want the perfect thing, the one answer that's going to resolve it. And if you don't mind me telling you a little bit of a story, one of the people that inspires me most is the artist Yo-Yo Kusama. And part of the reason for that, if the listeners aren't aware, she's an incredible Japanese multidisciplinary artist who has become one of the most successful artists in the world whilst living with very severe mental illness. And I think it's partly the intrigue of us coming from such different cultural backgrounds, but also how her mental illness has not only become a part of her work, it's become such a fascinating part of why people love her. And that's wonderful for me to see, that as much as I love the recovery model and I'm really kind of focused on people getting the support and breaking down stigma, it's also incredible to see that at the age of 93, she's still doing at least 100 works of art every year. And she lives full time in a residential psychiatric facility and every day gets up, has her breakfast with everyone else there, goes across the road to her multi-million, well, I'm going to say dollar, I don't know what it is in yen, art studio, and, you know, works, has her passion, and part of her art is these like replication of dots that carries through much of her work. And that's a reflection of her experiences of schizophrenia and synesthesia, where she puts some of the hallucinations that she has into her work. And that's an outlet, much in the way other people journal. And then she goes back to the facility and sleeps there. And that's her routine. And she's become one of the most, you know, successful people in her field with this experience of mental illness running alongside, you know.
I think that's so beautiful, the way you've said that, running alongside. I suppose it's not that I'm for or against any kind of model if it's working for people, but I do feel that piece about recovery is that idea, that exactly what you said, that it's doing it to get recovered and then it's done. You know, whereas the thing is that our mental health is with us this journey our whole lives, and it's going to change. So this idea that it can be concurrent, you know, and that it's something that is happening alongside us or as part of our life, I think that's really important for people to hear and to start understanding. And it's certainly something that I witnessed in my life when I had my first mental breakdown, if you want to call it that, or hospitalization, whatever. I came out of that and I worked so hard to get my life back. And I did all the stuff that I was supposed to do. I did my medication, I did the therapy, I did all the stuff. And I was doing really, really well. And about a year and a half later, I had a really bad crush and I got really unwell again. And I tell you, it absolutely broke my heart because I didn't understand that recovery didn't mean recovered, that it wasn't a done thing. And nobody had explained clearly to me that this is something precious that you need to mind and you need to work on every single day. And that it is a thing that you get out of it, what you put in. And I know we hear those kind of things all the time, but also to your point, that piece of, this is just part of your story. It's only part of who you are, if you even want to say that. It's an experience that you're having that may or may not shape other things or may or may not be shaped by the things that are in the rest of your life. And I think it was only when I started really fighting for my wellness that I started to understand that. And that was after maybe 14 years of living in very much unwellness and living for that because it was all I knew how to do. So I think that concept of having a life and having a routine and being able to live with your mental illness, regardless of what that looks like, I think is a really important message and that people can and do recover. Because I certainly never knew until it happened to me. And I think that's why it made me such a strong advocate to tell people, no matter how bad life gets, you know, I was on a life support for 8 days back in 2008. If I can get to that point in my life after so many years of being unwell, and I can now come to a place where I'm not on medication and I own my own house, I have my first BMW and I run a national program that deals with mental illness. If I can do all of that, anybody can. And I think that's such an important message because when I was growing up, I had nobody to look to. And it goes back to that piece about not having those conversations, that my world was so small thinking about mental illness and thinking about mental health because there was no voices talking about it. The only place that we had those conversations was in the psychiatric hospital. And I think it's really amazing now to see how many conversations are being had and how many people are being brave to step forward and say, yeah, do you know what? I've had this experience too. And I think it's what really ties us together as human beings, that we are the shared collective. And to that point earlier about, even if I haven't had the same experience as you, I can understand that it might have been difficult for you or it might currently be difficult for you and I can walk beside you in it. So I think that's a really important piece about our mental health, that whether it's we're walking beside ourselves in that mental health thing. It's like, you know, there's a part of me that is holding the space for when I get better. Or maybe it's that I'm holding the space for somebody while they're experiencing a mental health difficulty. It's this piece of let's do it and run beside each other as we're going.
Yes, you're so right. I can really relate to all of that. And it is a difficult thing to wrap your head around, this idea of recovery being something to aim for, but the aim not necessarily being a specific place. You know, it's more of an ongoing ambition. And that absolutely, if you have a relapse, if things get really difficult again, that means nothing detrimental about you. That doesn't mean that you failed or that you're written off or that you know, giving up is all that's left for you. You can absolutely still get back on that recovery train. And, you know, I think that's part of why Yo-Yo fascinates me, where it's something that I think is very important to stay open-minded to, that as much as we can be used to, you know, which is a very exciting thing, we can be used to certain stories in the media of such and such a celebrity experience this, now they don't anymore. You know, there is still this kind of bias towards those sort of binary stories, when in fact, there's a million, well, I mean, you could argue there's like 7 billion ways to recover. You know, there's a way for every person, you know, and that's why stories like that and stories like, you know, all my guests share inspire me to remember that it's different for everyone. And I think it's whatever way you need to regain control and peace within yourself and not be ruled by mental illness. That doesn't mean it won't at times take back the wheel, but, you know, whatever it is that's your recovery. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think the thing that I find most interesting is that for the different diagnoses that I've had, I mean, I've been told that they're lifelong, and yet I don't experience the majority of them anymore. So is it that I'm cured and I'm recovered, or is it that I live in recovery so that as long as I do my preventative measures and I put the things in place and I do the work, am I just keeping it at bay? I don't know is the answer. And the thing is, actually, I don't really care, because as long as I do the stuff and it keeps me well, then that's all I need to know. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the bit for me, that it's those tiny choices that I make over and over again that keep me in well-being. And when I have a slip in or I have a dip, because we all do, I mean, right now it's lashing rain here. It's not the night since today.
Yeah.
There is a lot going on at work. We have a lot of changes, like I mentioned to you earlier before we started recording. There's a lot of things that I could look at in my life and say, you know what, I'm having a tough time. And so now what I do is on those days, I say, okay, well, what do I need for today? Because here's the thing. We live on a continuum from 0 to 100. And most of us want to be up at 100, but we normally aren't. But let's say we live between 50 and 70. So if I'm having a day that I'm not great, maybe I'm only at 40. But if I give 40% on that day, when 40 is all I've got, I'm still giving 100%. And I think that's the bit that we really need to wrap our heads around, because when we're thinking about our mood and our mental health, we smack ourselves so hard with judgment because we want to be at 100, or we want to be at 70. And now that's an additional thing to be hard on ourselves about. So it really is about understanding that our mental health moves like the tide all of the time. And it's about going with that flow and saying, what do I need right now in this moment to either hold me in this space or to move up one, so that if I'm going to improve, I'll be at 41. I'll get back to 70. I'll get back to 100. But I only can do it one step at a time, and it takes pressure off. So I really feel like to understand our mental well-being, which includes this dis-ease, because that's what we're talking about, really, this uneasiness that we have around difficult emotions or around negative emotions. And the thing is, there's nothing bad about them. It's just that they're telling us something, they're giving us information that we're not comfortable processing, or that we don't understand, or that we don't know how to make meaning from. And I think those are the bits to understand, that that's part of this beautiful life, and that it's how we respond to it, because quite often we react and we don't allow ourselves to have a response. And I think that's what's changed in my life, that, you know, I give myself a chance to think about it and say, well, what's that about? Or what, you know, if I feel something, is there a reason, or is it just my mood is like that today and I don't need a reason? And what can I do right now to hold me in a kinder space? And what can I do that tomorrow, wherever, will thank me for?
Oh, That's so great to hear that you're in that place. And I may steal from you that dis-ease versus disease, because that's so good. And I also want to add, with what you shared about, you know, not knowing where you are in terms of diagnosability, I think there is such a opportunity there that as we push back against stigma, you know, those early experiences you described where it took in some ways a suicide attempt for it to become clear just how bad things were for you. Not only can we all do a better job of understanding what the symptoms are that would have come before that, but also, you know, by having preventative measures, I think there's so much more that's sort of really just not embraced yet in terms of the vagueness before a specific diagnosis. You know, so first of all, what things can we do to prevent you getting to a stage where your symptoms add up to a diagnosis in the first place? But then further than that, I'm fascinated in this concept of no longer meeting the diagnosable criteria, to use the kind of doctor language around it, where you could have had that diagnosis. It could still be something, I believe in your case, bipolar 1, right, was one of them. You know, that could still be something that if you get bad again, that will be the most relevant diagnosis. But there's still a possibility that with where you're at now, you won't meet enough of the symptoms for that to be your current reality. And that is quite exciting when, yes, conditions like bipolar so often are framed as lifelong, but it sounds like you're describing how it can be lifelong in terms of a reason to look after your mental health, which we all have those reasons, but it's an extra reason and it's not a life sentence like the stigma would have us believe.
Yeah. And the other thing I think is really important is the empowerment piece in it, because it really is this thing of when somebody gets diagnosed with something, and I'm sure this is very similar for people who have physical diagnoses with different diseases, that, you know, there is an element of learning through it. What does that mean for me? What does it mean now? You know, who am I with this? Who am I going to be? Who have I been? All of those things. But there's also something in the diagnostic phase where we're, you mentioned the medical model, we're very much leaning into that space of, you know, the doctor. And when we're thinking about medical model, usually it's going to be, I'm going to the doctor to fix this thing, to treat this issue. And it's isolated, or, you know, it's taken out of context of the whole person. And I think the other thing that we do is we really give over our power. And it's certainly something that I did for most of my life when I was waiting for somebody to fix me, really waiting for somebody to do something to me to make this experience go away. And I think it was only after that really severe suicide attempt that I realized that I was the only one who could change it. And I'd say the sickening thing or the funny thing is that I have heard that so many times in my life, and my family have, that, you know, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. And I suppose I was very lucky in ways that I had all the support. I have an amazing family. I have good friends. I had the medical team behind me. I had all of the supports. I was missing the fundamental bit that I needed to want it. I needed to do it and I needed to drive it. And it was only when I took that control and started saying, this is what I want. This is what I can do. This is what I'm capable for. Or I'm afraid of doing this, so I've handed it over to you all the time, but maybe I need you to help me do it in fear anyway, so that I learn how to control how I feel about these things, or that I get stronger in doing them and that I challenged myself. And it was only in going through that experience that I learned how to use my voice to advocate for my own well-being. And so that when things came up, like let's say I was talking with my psychiatrist and he wanted to go down a particular route and I wasn't really happy about it, in previous times I would have just gone with it and then probably stopped taking the medication or done whatever. Whereas now it was a matter of, I'm going to have a conversation to help you help me. And it was really empowering for me to understand that I had a role to play and that I was just as valid as every other voice. And also that I was the only expert on me, because I am the only person that has spent 365 days a year, every single year of my life with me. So those kind of mind melt shifts were the kind of things that it took for me to suddenly go, self-esteem is very low and I don't feel important, but I need to do something because nobody else can fix this for me. So I need to be brave and do this in the hope that one day I'll be happy with what I did and that I will care about myself more. And sure enough, that's what happened, that I did the fake it till you make it. I don't feel like doing it. I don't want to do it. And it literally was, I'm going to pretend that I want to do this. And I would go for the walk and I would start eating healthy and I would go to bed early and I did all the stuff, even though I hated every minute of it. But what happened was my body started getting better. I started being less tired, less cranky, better nutrients, all the stuff. And little by little by little, I started being able to do more. And the more I could do, the more I wanted to do. And all of that fed into me starting to feel better in my head. And I think that's the bit for a lot of people who experience mental health difficulties, that they feel lost, they feel disempowered, they don't feel capable of fixing it. So for me, that message that nobody has to fix it, that it's a matter of you are enough, that you do have capacity to do something, and it's up to you to choose what it is you would like to start with. Because it isn't about fixing it all, it isn't about doing it all in one go, but it's about saying, start tiny. And if going for a walk is too much, start with putting your shoes on. And if all you can do for today is put your shoes on and you don't make it out the door, you put your shoes on. So tomorrow, if it's you put your shoes on and you open the front door, if that's as far as you get, you're winning. And I think that's the shift that we need to get to and stop judging ourselves for all the stuff we're not doing.
That's brilliant. And to come on to another big shift in your life, you went from learning so much about mental health through your own lived experience to then that becoming your work.
Yeah, and I feel so privileged and so grateful to work in this space. And I think it really came from that place of wanting to help other people. And I think in the first year after surviving that really bad suicide attempt, I think I started to think about things in a different way from a point of view of if things were different or that things should be different. And then I started getting really angry that so many people I know had or knew had died by suicide and what could have been done differently. And, you know, like everybody else, I got on the bandwagon of like, all the services are bad and nobody's doing anything. And then after a few months of kind of having a whinge on about all of that, I suddenly realized, you know what, you are somebody and you should do something. And that was the beginning of my advocacy journey and my journey into what I now do as my job. So I started knocking on doors and talking to mental health charities and anybody that would listen to let them know that I had had this really traumatic, really severe experience with mental illness, but that I got better and that people don't have to die. And I think that was really motivating for me to share this thing that somebody might not go as far as I had gone before they got help. And my timing was beautiful because at a time where I went to a mental health organization that I used to be a client of, they were just about to launch the mental health campaign to try and shift attitudes. And so they willingly opened the doors and said, if you would like to come and share your story as part of this platform, we would love to have you. And that was the beginning of my volunteering with Sea Change. And that was back in 2009. So we officially launched in 2010. So I volunteered and did a huge amount of media interviews, TV, radio, newspapers, all of that first year. And then we started developing programs through research that was being done nationally. And in 2013, we launched the Sea Change Workplace Program, and I became a workplace facilitator. So for 6 years, I then facilitated the Sea Change Workplace Program nationally to lots of different kind of organizations and corporates around Ireland. And then in 2018, the CEO of Shine, which is our parent organization, came to me and said, you know, you've been doing this for so long and you understand all the different parts of the program. Why don't you come on board? So I took over the team leader role in 2019 and I've been leading the team as a Shine staff member ever since. And I have to say it's a privilege of my life. And really, I suppose it's that walk in the walk to show people, you know, I talk about being open in your life, in your work, in your family business, all of the places where you show up. And I genuinely do it. And I feel very lucky and very privileged that I can and that people can hear my story, but take out of my story the bits that are relevant to them or that they can identify with and that it might help them get information somewhere or do something a little bit different.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. No, I love the work of Sea Change and the fact that you came from being an ambassador, you know, much like Owen and Sheila, who are other recent guests on the podcast, and, you know, to blow smoke at you for a moment, the organisations you would have worked with as well, you know, are big organizations that require a lot of change often when it comes to mental health, you know, and that's why, you know, they partner with Sea Change. So we're talking about Boots, AIB, like loads of big companies that we use every day. And, you know, I think we can't underestimate the impact that has of your employer showing up and saying, actually, we do value mental health and we're going to put some things in place and start that journey of being more understanding. And so, yeah, that combined with the public facing work of Shine, you know, I see all the time how much of a difference that makes.
It does. It's huge. And I think actually what I witnessed in the last 2 years, particularly, like obviously I've seen it over the last 10 years, but it's like the pandemic accelerated a lot of the work because a lot of organizations were looking at corporate social responsibility. They were looking at different pillars of well-being. But mental health has become front and center of this conversation. And for anybody who's listening that isn't aware of what their policies or procedures or what offerings are there from their organization, they should go and find out, because a lot of organizations offer an employee assistance program, which is usually telephone support and possibly counseling as well. And that's usually free and confidential. They have different services that they provide around reasonable accommodations. A lot of them will do seminars and different groups to try and get people engaged in different ways. And for a lot of people, it's really about putting down that piece of, if I do this, if I engage with this, is somebody going to judge me or treat me differently? Because the thing is that if an organization is going to the effort of putting all those things in place, it means that they should have the policies and procedures there to protect you as well. And also for people to understand that mental health is covered under the 9 grounds of discrimination. And there is employment law there as well. So there is an element of safety, but also to understand that as much as I would love for all organizations to be completely open and for it to be very safe, that we're still in this very steep learning curve around sharing our stories, around seeking support in our workplaces and all of those things. So while some of it is about stigma, some of it also is understanding procedures and what's in place. That's about doing it in an appropriate and safe way. And I think just to say as well, for somebody who maybe is considering sharing their story or considering going to somebody, whether it's, you know, a work colleague, whether it's a family member, whether it's a community member that they're in a group with, there's two things to remember. So one is about oversharing. So if it's the first time you're telling something, think a bit in advance what you're going to say and the impact it might have. And then also, what's the purpose of me telling the story to this person? Is it that I just want them to listen? Is it that I need their help? If it's that I need something from this conversation, what is that? So I can steer the conversation in that way. So I think it's really important that we vote when we decide we're going to have this conversation. How much of it is a now thing? And how much of it is testing and saying, well, I'm going to have this little conversation and see how that goes. And maybe down the line, I can ask for some more time with this person and do it in an appropriate way where we both have time. Because what I've also seen is that sometimes you're holding it in for so long and you suddenly decide now is the time because you can't hold it anymore. But maybe now is not the time for the person listening because they have another appointment or they have to collect a child or they have a deadline they have to meet. The space that you're in is really public and you know there's lots of different things, so for the listener to feel comfortable to say it's really important that you tell me this, but maybe now is not the time, can we come back this evening at 6 o'clock or can we meet tomorrow, but that we are responsible and not feeling dragged into that space, that we feel prepared and we feel that we can listen and support.
Yes, absolutely. And I'll add there that I can be very guilty of being the other side of that, where you don't need to know me that well to know that when I ask someone how they are, I really mean it. But then also I'm aware, you know, that as part of people feeling comfortable opening up to me, I also need to be mindful of the context there as well. You know, so if I'm going to ask a follow-up question and they're going to spill out, you know, the whole of how horrible their week has been, maybe that's a follow-up question for later, you know, when it's more appropriate, catch up with them, find when they're on their lunch break or something like that, versus, oh, let's do this now while we're both at work or on the way somewhere and we only have 5 minutes. Yeah. So yeah, no, I think you've already shed, like we, between us, it's already stigma left. No, it's so inspiring, the work you do. I really appreciate it. And we are going to wrap up now, but if people want to find out more about Sea Change, where should they go?
Well, obviously there's our website, that's seachange.ie, and that's S-E-E for seeing it with your eyes, because there is another organization called Sea Change with an A, and that is not us. So you can go to our website and that will give you information about all the different programs and all of our free resources. So all the research that I talked about, we've created guides and they're all there on the publications page. They're there for free download. If you're looking for us from a point of view of social media, we are on Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, LinkedIn and Twitter. And we are Sea Change IRL across all of the platforms. And except on LinkedIn, we are Sea Change IRL, the National Stigma Reduction Program. Bit of a mouthful, but it's just in case you're trying to tire. We also have a podcast that we ran 2 years ago that really might be of interest to some of your listeners as well. And that's Sea Change Sessions with the Little Gale. So that's one of our ambassadors that collaborated with us to host a whole series of talks with people who work in the profession and people who have lived experience of mental health difficulties. And it was all done across the whole year. And then lastly, reminding people about getting their support, that while Sea Change does a huge amount in stigma reduction, we don't actually do support services. So we would be signposting to the like of our parent organisation, Shine, Your Mental Health.ie, Aware, Pieta House, 508-08 and the Samaritans, all of those. But certainly if you are interested in reducing stigma in your workplace, in your community, you want to get a speaker, you want to order green ribbons, any of those things, you can reach us at seachange.ie or info@seachange.ie as well.
Brilliant. There you go. The resources are out there. There's loads. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.